Overall, today we have charged three people who organized these scams, two SAT or ACT exam administrators, one exam proctor, one college administrator, nine coaches at elite schools, and 33 parents who paid enormous sums to guarantee their children's admission to certain schools through the use of bribes and fake academic and athletic credentials.
U.S. Attorney Andrew Lilling announcing charges today in what he called the largest college admission scam the Justice Department has ever prosecuted. More than a dozen people caught up in the investigation are from the L.A. area, including actresses Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin. The schools involved include USC, UCLA, Stanford, Georgetown, Yale, and the University of Texas. Here to tell us more is Devlin Barrett, national security reporter at the Washington Post. Hi, Devlin.
Hi.
Also joining us is Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Hi, Scott.
Hi there.
Devlin, tell us more about the accusations. What exactly was the scheme that prosecutors presented today?
So the scheme basically worked along two tracks. They could basically what the advisor, the college admissions advisor, could do was take money from parents to either make up fake academic credentials for kids, essentially bribe college coaches to pretend that a student was a recruit to their team, or they could pay someone to take the entrance exams for the students so they could get a higher grade.
Okay, and the ringleader is allegedly this guy named William Rick Singer. He is, he has pled guilty today. And what did he do? What was he charged with?
Well, he's really the architect of the whole scheme. He acted as an advisor and said, basically, if you pay me this money, I can get your kid into whatever school you want. And so, for example, in one case, he took $1.2 million from a California couple to get their daughter into Yale. And the way he did that was he paid a bribe of $400,000 to Yale's, at the time, the head of Yale's women's soccer team, to basically pretend that that student was a recruit to the soccer team.
Okay. And the other, and that's one of the things that the actress Lori Loughlin, her daughters, were apparently presented as members of the USC crew team, even though they didn't play crew?
Right. That's the accusation, yes.
Okay, that's the accusation. I just want to play a clip of one of the daughters, Olivia, updating her nearly 2 million YouTube followers on her plans for college.
My first week of school, I'm leaving to go to Fiji for work, and then I'll be in New York a bunch this year. That's for work. So I don't know how much of school I'm going to attend, but I'm going to go in and talk to my deans and everyone and hope that I can try and balance it all. But I do want the experience of, like, game days, partying. I don't really care about school, as you guys all know.
Okay. So, Devlin, any indication that the students knew what was going on?
There seem to be cases where the students knew, and there seem to be, frankly, cases where the parents went out of their way to make sure the students didn't know what the parents were doing for them. There's a case of a venture capital big shot in Northern California who went to a lot of trouble to make sure his son did not find out that he was basically paying a lot of money and telling a lot of lies to get his son into the school he wanted to go to.
And the charges against Felicity Huffman, those are the SAT cheating charges?
Right. So she is accused of paying one of these folks for so that someone else, I believe, would take the test for her child. To be honest, to be fair to Ms. Huffman, the charges against her are less intense than some of the charges against some of the other parents, but she is still charged with a crime.
Okay, and her husband, William H. Macy, not charged.
Correct. And what you see in the charges, so there's 33 parents that have been charged, and what you see in the charges is sometimes it's the father that's charged, sometimes it's the mother, sometimes it's both parents, and that seems to be based on who was interacting with, you know, sort of the bribe receiver and the bribe, you know, the Mr. Singer, the guy who's sort of arranging all this.
Okay. Scott Jasek, you cover this world.
You know
all the ins and outs. What is your reaction to today's announcement, these indictments?
So it's obviously shocking when you hear about people spending these sums of money to really rig the system. But ultimately, actually, what goes on in elite higher education is there are tons of advantages for wealthy people. And the things that these parents were taking advantage of are real and not well understood. So, for instance, people think that football factories are the ones that care about athletes. In fact, elite colleges, it is a huge advantage if you are a recruited athlete. That's why this was so valuable, a backdoor in, as one of the documents says. People don't like to think about places like Stanford and Yale valuing athletics to this extent, but they do. So in this case, they were valuing faux athletes.
And in this case, it was soccer mainly and crew, sailing, tennis, those kinds of sports, not football, basketball, baseball.
And the sports that they were talking about are sports that, with exceptions, that help a lot of wealthier students get into college. I mean, that's, again, the underlying thing. It's sort of great that there's all this outrage over this, but there are massive advantages for the wealthy that are legal. In some ways, that's what makes this so surprising. A savvy, wealthy parent can do an awful lot to increase the odds of a son or daughter getting into a good college.
Yeah, let me play another clip of tape from the U.S. attorney, Andrew Lelling, that sort of addresses what you're talking about.
The parents charged today, despite already being able to give their children every legitimate advantage in the college admissions game, instead chose to corrupt and illegally manipulate the system for their benefit. We're not talking about donating a building so that a school's more likely to take your son or daughter. We're talking about deception and fraud, fake test scores, fake athletic credentials, fake photographs, bribed college officials.
Okay, so the indictment also makes clear that the universities in large measure cooperated with the investigation and the prosecution, that they were largely unaware of what the individuals in the athletic directors and coaches were doing, allegedly accepting these bribes. However, in terms of the actual effect of who gets into college and who doesn't, there is a difference, and yet it seems, Scott, that there isn't a difference. It's about paying for access.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess the one question I would ask the U.S. attorney is, I'm not sure most people would think it's a good thing if someone pays for a building so that their son or daughter gets in over an otherwise better qualified candidate. And it's not just access, it's everything. It's what high school you went to. It's how many counselors are at that high school. It's whether you had SAT tutoring. It's whether you had somebody help, quote, help you write your essay. The legal advantages are tremendous. And so, you know, the reality is these children of these parents, they would have ended up just fine if their parents had stuck to what's legal.
Right. And so, Devlin, is that addressed at all in this indictment in terms of, you know, how they made a decision to go the extra mile, if you will, and tread into the illegal waters rather than just make a big fat donation? These are, after all, wealthy people.
They are wealthy people, but I think, look, I am not an expert in how universities work. It's been, frankly, been a while since I've been in one. But I think, in my mind, the issue here is that these folks just wanted a guaranteed in, and they were willing to pay someone under the table. I mean, think about a bribe to a soccer coach of $400,000 for a single student to get in. I do think this is a categorically different enterprise than, you know, making a donation. These folks wanted to say, these folks were very clear in some of these conversations, many of which were recorded, remember. A lot of this involves wiretaps of conversations of parents talking about exactly what they want and what they're willing to pay for it. And they wanted guaranteed entrance of their kid for X dollars, and they were willing to bribe people under the table to do it. That's a crime in under federal law. It's fairly clear cut.
So who was wearing the wire? The William Rick Singer, the
Well, part of, what, part of what happens is here is that the FBI clearly went after. This case has only been going on for about a year, which is not that long in the world of federal investigations. And part of what the FBI did here was they took the people who were sort of the facilitators of all this, the bribe takers and bribe payers, and they flipped them, most of them. So the Yale soccer coach flipped. William Singer, the guy who's really the architect of the whole thing, he flipped. And so all these people are cooperating. And there's an amazing recording where one of the parents says, what happens if someone finds out about this? And Singer says, well, the only way someone's going to find out it is if you guys talk. And, you know, within months of that conversation, Singer is talking to the FBI.
Hmm. And how was he caught in the first place?
They say the FBI stumbled onto this whole thing kind of accidentally. They were running an undercover investigation completely unrelated to this. And one of the people they were talking to mentioned this scheme. And as the FBI started pulling back layers, you know, people kept flipping. And they say they're not done yet. They say there could be more people charged, that this is only the result of, you know, a year-long investigation, and there could be more to find here.
Okay, so 50 people are charged so far in about six states. So it seems like a pretty big investigation. I guess it just strikes me as a little bit unusual that they would flip the ringleaders. I mean, isn't that the top of the heap, that they would want this guy to go to jail?
It is, except it's pretty clear that he is, you know, sort of a contractor for the parents. Think about, you know, so they say Singer processed about $25 million in bribes, but just one of those bribes for one kid was $1.2 million. In another case, you know, the bribe was, you know, something on the order of $6 million. So, you know, I think the FBI views all of these folks as criminals. But I think they're particularly harsh on the parents who were willing to pay basically almost any sum of money to guarantee their kid's entrance into a particular school.
Scott, what does it mean for these top-tier universities? Does this mean an NCAA investigation? USC is no stranger to scandal of late. And so what does it mean in the broader sense for these schools?
I think there could be investigations by the NCAA, by their accreditors, by others. I think actually the bigger problem is in the how the public views these colleges. Already, colleges are subject to a lot of scrutiny of their decisions. Many consider the admissions process some sort of mystery that they can't figure out. Others view it and attack affirmative action. Colleges do not benefit from a sense that the system can be rigged. That hurts the way people view higher ed and reinforces a lot of images that people have about the system being unfair and favoring the wealthy. You know, right now there's this big lawsuit against Harvard that could result in limits on the way colleges can help Black and Latino students. And it's not really a positive thing to, at the same time, having it being revealed how the wealthy rigged the system.
Okay. And Devlin, final question to you. What possible prison sentences, if any of these parents are found guilty, what are they facing?
Well, we really don't know what the prison sentence is going to be yet. One of Singer, the person we mentioned earlier, he pleaded guilty to racketeering conspiracy, which carries, you know, potentially decades in prison. But because he's cooperating, he's likely to get far less than that. I think under federal sentencing guidelines, some of these folks will face the possibility of years in prison. But I also think realistically, because so many of them are likely to be first-time offenders, what you tend to see in white-collar criminal cases is that they get much less than you know, what's on the books.
All right. Devlin Barrett, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Scott Jasek, editor at Inside Higher Ed. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the Central Valley city of Fresno is home to a meth epidemic. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Fresno has a pretty serious meth problem. That's according to a Vice Media episode that recently went viral.
They're going to use. That's the nature of the issue of addiction. That no matter what the negative consequences are, they're going to continue with their drug use. So how do you compete against that? Yeah, how do you compete when there's not a lot of opportunities, basically looking at a warehouse job if you're lucky, or it's out in the fields? And, you know, it's not a good life working in the fields. You know, like, it's really rough.
Fresno used to be a hub for meth production in the United States, but even as the manufacturing of the drug moved south of the border, the addiction rates there still remain really high. Vice's Latinx reporter Paola Ramos went to Fresno to learn what's driving the city's Latino community to use meth, and she joins us now. Hi, Paola.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you. Okay, so you went to Fresno Central Valley. Why Fresno in particular?
Yeah, so actually the reason that I started finding out about this issue was through one of my grad school friends. She's from the Valley, but we went to school in Boston. And in a casual conversation, she said, yes, my mom is a meth user. My brother is a meth user. You know, it is a problem that is in my family. And that's the second that I realized that there was just, you know, her story was a larger story. And that's simply that the Latino community there, which is, you know, more than 50%, is using this drug, you know, both as a way to make money and also as a way to sort of cope with the realities that they're going through on a daily basis.
Okay, so to make money. So in other words, they're dealing as well. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we found some, of course, and we can't generalize because there's angles to every story. But we found, we talked to various people, particularly Latinos that are working in the fields, that are in farm working. And they said that there's moments where it's you make more money dealing meth than you do in the fields. It's a job. No, it gets you more money. So that was one angle that kept coming up, where people are simply, it's easy. It's easy to access, and it's easy to deal, and you make money.
I want to play a clip of tape from a drug dealer. You interviewed him. He was really honest, and he went on camera. Mm. So I guess he wasn't afraid of being arrested. So,
no.
And he talked about Prop 47, which reduced the possession of some drugs from a felony to a misdemeanor.
If the cops came right now and found that all these drugs on us right now, none of us would go to jail. They'd give you a ticket and send you on your way and leave you with your meth. They don't even take
it. Is that a good thing?
No, absolutely not. It's a good thing for criminals, and it's a good thing for drug addicts. But as far as the society as a whole, that's horrible. Because what that did is now kids have meth. No one's scared to have it anymore.
Okay, so, I mean, he's kind of saying that he should be arrested himself, but he's not because of Prop 47?
Yeah, I mean, yes. And that's, you know, I think you'll find people that think different things about that. We also talked to law enforcement, and they had a similar reaction as well as you could imagine. But again, who do you blame, right? It's a cycle, and there's many entry points to it. But the question really is, where do you end the cycle?
Right.
Do you criminalize it? I'm not so sure if that's the answer. But that's the question to me. No, it's where does this cycle end, and where can we step in and to help?
And also, where does it begin? So
exactly.
you talked about it affecting the Latino community disproportionately, mainly because they have dead end jobs and they're kind of using it as a way to cope.
Yeah, I mean, there's many angles there. One is that it's an intergenerational drug, right? Which is another thing that we found. My friend is a perfect example, but we found that in other interviews that didn't make the cut, which is, you know, my family was exposed to it. My mom used it. Therefore, I was, you know, this drug was sort of normalized. And another reality was the undocumented side of it, right? Like immigrants that come to this country, they think that they're expecting something else. And then they use it as a way to sort of like cope with depression, you know, cope with the fact that they're not, it's not as easy as they thought. No, this American dream doesn't really exist in many cases. So this drug becomes a way to escape that.
I was also intrigued by this idea that it makes working in the fields easier and they're more productive when they're on meth, when they're picking.
Yeah, I don't, again, that was you know, one person that said that. We know from other research and from other stories that working in the field is not easy. It's grueling. It's, you know, the hours are crazy. It's 127 degrees for many people. So again, we can't generalize, but In cases, especially since we know how hard the conditions are and how little supervision there is in terms of the actual like labor conditions that a lot of this community is going through, I can imagine why again, this detaches yourself from reality, and makes life a little bit easier, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
And how much does it cost?
I mean, the drug dealer that you saw, he said that it was like, sometimes you can get it for like $10, $20. I mean, it depends, right? But that interview that you see with the dealer, he literally was just walking down, and we just happened to see him. But that's normal, right? Like him swinging the bag of meth to us and just putting it in my face, like that's common.
Like, and he didn't care that he was on camera.
No, we asked obviously several times, and we wanted to protect his identity, but no. And he said, look behind me. This guy used to be in IHOP. He used to work at IHOP. This other guy used to run a business, and like, here they are, right? And that sense is evident there.
And so then you visited a free needle exchange center, which really put it in perspective in terms of how many addicts there are. Mm-hmm. A lot of addicts use meth intravenously. They use needles. And so let me just play this tape from your interview with one of the workers.
On a typical Saturday, how many people come in here?
Today, we saw 149 people.
Wow.
And we did about 21,000 today. So it was a little bit busy.
21,000 syringes.
Yeah, in 2 hours.
In 2 hours, 21,000 syringes.
Just, so you can imagine, in a weekend, exactly. And a lot of those folks that we spoke to, we asked them, and I asked them, like, will this, because one of the guys that was there, the doc said that he was on the verge of having a heart attack, right? And that was a conversation, like, if you do this one more time, you will die. And we would ask them, like, are you going to go home? Like, will this make you rethink, the next time you do it? And the answer was many times like, yes, but I'm not going to stop. And that's what the doctors would tell you. They're not there to make to end the crisis, right? This is just a little Band-Aid. But unless it comes from yourself, there is no way to end it. And most people we talked to said, no, this won't deter them from doing it again.
And so we hear a lot about opioids and heroin. Is that not as big a problem as meth there?
No, we found that it's not. That's not what the Central Valley is dealing with. And again, we talked a little bit about it, right? How the highway that crosses California, and starting from the border, it's just this like easy access.
The five.
Like straight, exactly. The five, the shot that makes this drug extremely accessible in Fresno.
It's interesting how it comes across. Can you describe that, how they hide it when it comes across the border?
Yeah, I mean, they say that many times it's because it's in liquid form, you could put it in the tires. So it comes in and it's liquid. You could put it in tires. You can put it as part of gasoline. And many times when they're crossing the checkpoints, when they're crossing the border, it's very hard to detect because it is sort of it's a liquid form. It looks like gasoline. You don't really know what it is. So and they just go.
So when it comes across in liquid form, how do they turn it back into the crystals?
They freeze it. They crystallize it. No, they literally convert it into like crystal meth, which is the term that a lot of people use. And then that's where the sort of distribution and the packaging starts. But that liquid form is then crystallized. No, they go through a whole process in the labs where they crystallize that, and that happens in the States, in this case in the Central Valley. And from there on, it goes to be distributed. But that initial part of like creating the meth, again, that's in the Mexican side of the border. They pass it through still in liquid form. And then once you reach the United States, then they crystallize it.
And Fresno, not Bakersfield, not any of the other Central Valley cities. It's mainly Fresno.
What we found is in Fresno. That's where the cartels have sort of found, their anchor. And that's maybe for another story, right? To me, the question is like, why are Latinos in that area? Like, why are they drawn to this drug? And again, a Latino in Bakersfield, same, right? The whole farm worker movement is there. There's a lot of farm workers. A lot of the struggles are similar in the Central Valley. But we found that the anchor of the drug, where I guess the action is happening, is in Fresno.
Well, Paola, thank you. That was a really interesting report. Thank you.
No, thank you so much for spotlighting me.
Paola Ramos, Vice Media's Latinx reporter, and you can check out her documentary on Fresno and meth at vice.com. Coming up, how to shoot a sex scene in the Me Too era.
If actors want to do sex work, that is fine, God bless. But with our laws, with our business laws, with our union protocols, that is not what we're asking actors to do.
How an intimacy coordinator does her job, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means we have our TV segment called TV on the Radio. No
one told you that was... This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are the four myths. The actual retail price is...
We're going to talk about the show Smilf. It's about a hard luck single mom in Boston. It received critical acclaim and was up for 2 Golden Globes last year. It was renewed for a second season, and Frankie Shaw is the creator, star, and showrunner.
Bridge, I have my AA meeting today at 4 o'clock. I'm making the coffee.
You've been sober for over a year. Can't you miss one meeting to take your kid to the doctor?
You want me to bail on my coffee commitment, Bridge? I can't do that.
Okay, so I'm going to rush through my job, which houses, clothes, and feeds our kids so you can make coffee. Is that that's what's happening?
However, late last week, ABC Signature Studios announced it is canceling this show and suspending Shaw's pay while it investigates allegations against her. Those allegations include people not getting credited for their work, writers being separated by race, and the mishandling of sex scenes. Kim Masters is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. She broke this story last year, and she's been reporting on it since then. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so tell us about the alleged misconduct that you discovered, and what did you find out was going on the set of Smilf?
You know, I have covered movies and sometimes TV shows where the cast and crew turn on somebody and lose faith in the showrunner, but this was really extraordinary. I got one tip and made like 1.5 phone calls, and I was just overwhelmed with people that then started to call me with stories from the set, particularly of the second season, but also the first on this show, this Showtime show, Smilf. And Frankie Shaw is the show. I mean, it's based on a version of her life. And she, you know, is the star. So there isn't, it's not like they can get rid of her and still carry on with the show. She plays this mom. Rosie O'Donnell played her mother. She had a really good cast. And what happened is she just seems to have been an abuser. I mean, there were allegations. Over more than 20 people calling the anonymous tip line at Disney, which is the parent of the ABC studios that produced the show. There were complaints to particularly the Writers Guild about the credit issues. Shockingly, complaints that the writers' room was, as you mentioned, segregated by race and not by accident. These are the allegations. And there were mishandled sex scenes. One of the stars of the show, this actress Samara Weaving, she had in the first and second season incidents. Ultimately, it was seen as the breach of her contract, in which it seems that nude scenes that she was playing, love scenes, were handled with great insensitivity. In the first season, she was allegedly bullied. She had a, you know, reluctance to do a certain kind of thing in this love scene. And in the second season, there were monitors turned on. This was supposed to be a closed set. It absolutely, I was told Frankie Shaw herself instructed that the monitors be turned on, even though there was a preliminary conversation that this is very sensitive with the actors, with the director. And nonetheless, with lots of crew and various people on the show watching, monitors were turned on. This was considered a breach, and the actress actually left the show.
Wow. And she was one of the stars of the show. She wasn't just a character.
She was regular.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the explanation for this? Has Frankie Shaw come out and explained any of this?
She kind of said, I just really was inexperienced and I didn't know. And there are two things wrong with that. One of which is there's a very competitive Writers Guild program for showrunners, and she was in it. She got a place in it. So she had training. And the other problem is there are executives at Showtime, executives at ABC Studios, executive producers on the show who, with a relatively young new showrunner like Frankie Shaw, are supposed to be the adults in the room. And I have to say, it seems like that was a complete fail. This thing only started to be an issue when Rosie O'Donnell, who I feel bad for because she really did a good performance as this character's mom, she initially reported, based on the nude scene in the second season, that something was wrong on the set. And it seems that, you know, the reaction was border between slow and non-existent. Only when we published a story about these allegations did they, I would say grudgingly, say they would investigate.
Okay. Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter, host of KCRW's The Business. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you.
So what would have happened if SMILF had had an intimacy coordinator, you know, someone to make sure everyone felt comfortable and safe when shooting sex scenes? In October, HBO announced that an intimacy coordinator will be on set whenever a sexually intimate scene is shot. That person is Alicia Rodas. She's associate director and co-founder of Intimacy Directors International, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I am great, thank you. So what exactly is an intimacy coordinator?
An intimacy coordinator is a movement coach or a movement director, an advocate for actors, and a liaison between actors and production. So I like to think that we are the connective tissue between what we see on the page and what it is that happens when we are shooting.
So I imagine that you've had more work since Me Too happened.
That is absolutely correct. We started this a number of years ago in 2015. Myself and Tonya Sina and Siobhan Richardson created Intimacy Directors International after we had seen, you know, such a need for this kind of work. And we got some attention and, you know, we spent a while, you know, researching. And a lot of this was based on Tonya Sina's research that she started in 2004. And after doing this, you know, we researched with legal experts, with consent experts, trauma experts, other directors, and we were all movement directors and actors. And after going through all this, you know, we started put out workshops and our protocols, and people started to take some notice. And then Me Too happened. And obviously, people turned around and said, "What was that thing you were talking about again?" Mm-hmm. Because everyone sort of realized that we are coming, you know, I don't think Me Too was a few people acting badly. It was the idea, the realization that the way things were, our power dynamics and our systematic dynamics in the entertainment industry and in a lot of our industries really had some problems. So this is something in there to help mitigate that.
All right. So I guess I'm wondering exactly how this works without getting too, you know, graphic, but
sure.
It used to be that a director would say, "Okay, you two, get in the bed, pretend to have sex, and we'll shoot it," and that was that?
I mean, there are a lot of different ways to go about an intimate scene, but in general, what we have seen is that there is a lot of, you know, do what you feel like, go with your instincts, and I understand, you know, the want is from having an authentic performance, but the real story here is that what they are doing is fake. We are not asking actors to do sex work. We're not asking them to have an actual sexual experience. If actors want to do sex work, that is fine. You know, God bless. But with our laws, with our business laws, with our union protocols, that is not what we're asking actors to do. So I think for a while, you know, and we're going on how many years of filmmaking and theatrical practices where we've had this black hole of artistic and also practical ideals in our intimate scenes. So I know my experience as an actor was a lot of, "Hey, you two figure it out," or "You three figure it out," whoever's in the scene. I've had experiences and talked to plenty of actors who have had experiences of being on set and them saying, "You know what, this isn't working. Could you take your top off? Or, you know what, just take his pants off." And none of that is specified ahead of time.
Does all of that have to be specified?
Absolutely.
So what exactly is specified? Is it down to where you put your hand if you kiss the neck or the shoulder or the
necessarily that much. What we go with, we have things called nudity riders or waivers or simulated sex riders or waivers, which are addendums to contracts that are very commonplace in the industry. And what we do is make sure they say exactly what it is they are agreeing to as far as if they're agreeing to simulate a sexual act or what type of nudity it is that they are okay showing or not okay showing. It's not a blanket statement. And if people do want to work like that and say, "I'm okay with everything, I'll simulate anything, I'll show anything," fabulous, awesome. We can open that up and work within whatever boundaries people are working with.
Do you ever get a situation, though, where someone has said that and then when they're actually filming, they say, "Oh, never mind. I can't do this. I don't want to do this."
Oh, sure.
Even though they've signed the paper. And is there then a negotiation with the director and does it get a little fraught?
I mean, at the end of the day, if someone says, I am not going to do this, and it is something that with nudity, a sexual act, a violent act, what are you going to do? I mean, you say, okay, you're not going to, are you going to physically force someone to do it? Now, the problem here, of course, is there's a lot of coercion on set. What intimacy coordination does is allows us to get all those conversations ahead of time. And I can count on my one hand the number of times that someone has actually withdrawn consent in the moment, and that is because they didn't have all of the information ahead of time. So what we find is when actors know the information ahead of time, they know that they are going to be safe, they know that they're being advocated for, they know exactly what the shot is and what they're being asked to do, they feel then more empowered to do their best work. And that's what we really want here, you know? We don't want to censor anyone. Right. We want everyone to do their best work. And go figure, when actors know they're not going to be harassed or abused, they do their best work.
Do people do actual sexual acts?
There's a long history and lots of rumored and corroborated statements of people talking about actual sexual acts happening on
like
set.
Like actual
and
intercourse.
On stage. Sure. Yeah. Never when I have been there, but we're also very specific about it. And here's the thing. If we don't have specific protocols set for our intimate scenes, then we do open ourselves up to times where people can feel coerced into having actual sexual acts on set, to people feeling like they have to do things that, one, they can't be doing because of their union protocols, but also you as an actor are allowed to have personal boundaries. You know, I'm on the Deuce for, you know, and this is the second season we've been doing this, and I work on a lot of HBO shows. We do a lot of risque work, and I work with a lot of directors. And every time we can find a way within the boundaries of what the actors are agreeing to do and with how the directors like to work to make it safe and also exciting. And exactly,
this is about
the
porn industry in the Deuces, right?
That's
70s.
Correct.
So
it, yeah, 70s and 80s.
So I imagine the sex has to be pretty explicit.
Oh, surely. Yeah, we have to tell the story of very explicit sex.
But when you say, oh, I've heard stories of actors actually having sex, aren't they supposed to be wearing things that prevent that from happening? Isn't there material?
See, this is... yeah. See, this is part. Right. See, and this is part of it is, you know, even just that question, you can hear being like, so isn't there a thing that they wear underneath? It's really difficult to talk about these things and really put it out there explicitly what it is that we want people to wear and what to have between them. And God bless all of the costumers of our industry, because it has been them that have been forced into some really uncomfortable situations for many years of having to talk with actors and clear what's okay with them when it's not necessarily their jobs to do that. So when we're working with this, I work with costumes, and we make sure that we have, so there's modesty garments, which has been, you know, the old hat that we've used. There's a sort of sock situation that they have for people who have a penis. But that's for modesty. That's for I don't want you to see anything. Mm-hmm. And if we're telling a story of simulated sex or telling a story of sex and we have genitals up against each other, we want something else there. So some sort of padding, some sort of barriers that we make sure are there so that, one, there is sexual health that is cared for because, you know, God forbid someone has a sexual health issue going on, but also making sure that we have a little bit less feeling happening there so that if someone has a vascular reaction, the partner doesn't have to feel that. We normalize it. We know that just because you put your body in a certain position, you know, your body is going to want to replicate the pre-moments of that actually happening, but it's not actually happening. We're actors working together in a professional circumstance.
Mm-hmm. And are you in the room, if you will, or on set when it's happening, just to make sure that things don't get out of hand?
Absolutely. I speak with the actors and directors beforehand. I'm collaborating with costumes. I'm collaborating with makeup sometimes if there are prosthetics involved. And, you know, the AD department, I function a lot like a stunt coordinator. So when we get into those scenes where we do have the simulated sex or nudity, I'm making sure the protocols are going through, but I'm also assisting with choreography or anchoring or making sure we at least know that everything that's being done is consensual and no boundaries are being crossed.
Well, Alicia, thank you so much for providing this insight. It was really interesting.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Alicia Rodas. She's an intimacy coordinator at HBO and associate director and co-founder of Intimacy Directors International. Coming up, poppies and so many other wildflowers. The superbloom is attracting the masses, which is bad for the superbloom. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you've been on Instagram, you have seen pictures of the superbloom. An intense display of wildflowers this year is crazy because of all the rain. But with all the beauty comes a fair share of the ugly, people tromping the flowers to get their perfect pictures. Casey Schreiner is really upset about this. He's the founder and editor of Modern Hiker. Hi, Casey.
Hi, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again. So how upset are you?
I'm pretty upset. I mean, everything on the internet, you know, you have to be at least baseline furious to be on the internet.
Yeah.
So I'm like mildly furious about it, let's say.
Mildly?
Yeah.
Okay, what's making you so mad?
Well, it's, you know, a super bloom and, you know, even just a regular old bloom is a pretty amazing thing to see. We want people to get out there to experience these things, to be inspired, to be surrounded by the natural beauty of the state of California that's here year round. What we don't want, though, is people destroying that beauty as they are taking that beauty, especially if they, you know, are doing that for, you know, sponsored posts or, you know, doing it for the gram or trying to get likes or things like that. The problem is that, you know, one or two people doing this sort of stuff, you know, lying down in a field of poppies or whatever, wouldn't be that big of a deal. But you multiply that by the thousands and thousands of people who are doing it, and as super bloom season is really just kicking off, you can really see how that damage can spread pretty quickly.
Well, how long does it last, the damage?
Well, the damage could last for several seasons. You know, back in 2017, we had another super bloom, and there were some instances of state parks where, you know, people were cutting their own trails and destroying stuff and picking flowers so badly that actually naturalists and state park rangers had to go back and reseed this stuff to actually get it to recover the way it was before the super bloom.
So wait, a lot people of this are stuff- picking the flowers?
People are picking the flowers. People are, you know, building garlands for their hair. It's like a freaking Joni Mitchell cosplay event out there sometimes. It's nuts. And it's, you know, it's stuff that you see and you're like, what is wrong with you? Like, why would you ever think this is okay to do? And, you know, from people that have been out in these super bloom areas, the reaction that they get is people either don't know. If they don't know, they don't care. And they don't think they're doing anything wrong. So we're trying to sort of counteract that, especially on social media, using a hashtag called No Wildflowers Were Harmed.
Well, so let's say someone wants to go see these wildflowers. What should they do?
Well, they should go see them. I mean, again, they're amazing, amazing displays. I would really recommend, you know, if you're seeing a headline about a super bloom in a certain location, I would recommend going somewhere else, to be honest. A lot of these places, the experience is less of a natural inspirational event and more like a Black Friday sale. It's really, really crowded. A lot of the stuff is being destroyed. But blooms happen throughout the state of California, you know, from now through like July and even August, depending on what the elevation is, where you want to go. And we have a ton of resources on the site that, you know, will kind of help you find some of that stuff. A great place to check is the Theodore Payne Foundation. They're based up in the northern San Fernando Valley. Mm-hmm. And they do wildflower updates every week. And you can kind of see where stuff is looking good, where it may be pre-peak or even just post-peak. And those are kind of the times that you would want to visit if you want to avoid crowds.
Well, you just I hate to say wildlife. This, but you just alerted the crowds by saying that. You just
well,
did that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is that a lot of it is that sort of thing, doing that kind of research, it requires a bit of effort on the user's part. Where we get into trouble with social media is, especially if something is geotagged, where all you have to do is, you know, put your finger on that location and then you know exactly where to go. You've done no research. You don't know if it's a state park, if it's a freeway overlook or something like that. With the Theodore Payne Foundation, you've got to actually dig in through some PDFs and, you know, deal with some, I mean, and I say this as one of these myself, you have to deal with some plant people first.
Okay. You just said PDF. I was like, ooh, I don't know if I can do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. But you could just, you don't have to go to these places, right? You could just like walk around Griffith Park or something.
I literally was in Griffith Park last week doing field work for a book I'm working on about the park. Had no intention of searching out blooms. It's just, this is the best time of year to be outside in Southern California, regardless of whether or not you see any blooms. So I was trying to take advantage of that. And I came across some beautiful, beautiful flowers, a golden currant that was kind of literally sticking itself in the middle of a trail for me. There was some sage that looked like it was about to bloom. And I know we talked about these last time I was on, but monkey flowers, they're not blooming yet, but they are very, very happy in Griffith Park right now. And in another couple of weeks, they're going to be all over the place. You do not need to be following the crowds to see some of these blooms. You can be hiking almost anywhere in Southern California right now.
When you go, do you take pictures and post them on Instagram? I'm just wondering.
I do. I basically, if I'm taking photos for Instagram, you'll note I'm usually not in them. It's a photo of the flower, and it's usually one or two flowers. One of the things that we tried to get people to think about was kind of like, what is the message you're posting when you're posting something to social media, and why are you posting to social media? So when I'm posting flowers to social media, I am highlighting what the native plants are, usually getting a scientific name, kind of showing off how beautiful they are, even if you've got to get, you know, really close up with, you know, your iPhone macro lens to do it. And I might be talking about the region or the trail or like when you might expect to see them. What I'm not doing is, you know, holding a can of Campbell's soup, lying down in the field of poppies and doing a hashtag, you know, branded ad for a major company and using the flowers as a backdrop to sell stuff. I'm trying to teach people about the plants themselves.
Okay. I want to ask you about something different, but related.
Yes.
And that is, I was driving into work today and I saw all these butterflies flying over the tent.
Yes.
What's up with that?
So these are called painted ladies. They're actually one of the most common butterflies throughout the world. But they are on a migration right now, and their migration route up into Oregon is right over LA, and it's today. I have a lot of friends out. I have a friend who's out in Griffith Park right now, and she's done a couple live videos. And the butterflies, you can see them almost in every single shot that she's in. They're kind of just flying around everywhere right now. So again, nature is in LA. It's a great time to get out and enjoy it. Just please don't kill it to take a photo.
You just have to be on the 10.
Or even on the 10, yeah, if you want to distract yourself. But again, you know, pay attention to the car that's in front of you.
Okay. All right, Casey, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Casey Schreiner, he is founder and editor of Modern Hiker. That's from our director, Sarah, playing the Elton John Painted Lady song.
What's wrong with making some garlands? That's what I wanted. I like garlands.
Just go to Trader Joe's and buy some flowers and make your garland. Don't pick the flowers. Hi, Christian Bordeaux.
Oh, boy, I hardly know where to start today, Madeline Brand. That college bribery scandal investigation that came out today, it has been swirling around social media. Shauna Lynn writes, remember when your kid got waitlisted and you blamed some undeserving kid from the ghetto for stealing your kid's spot? Now you know who the real culprits are. Aunt Becky, a desperate housewife, and probably your boss. Even Donald Trump Jr. No, not our
boss.
Just
in general.
Even Donald Trump Jr. tweeted in on this one. He said, he just wrote Hollywood. I guess because, you know, Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman were two of the 50-odd people charged. Quite a few people, though, took exception to Donald Jr.'s tweet. Comedian Zach Bornstein tweeted back, ooh, would not wade into this one, champ. And Franklin Leonard tweeted, how about this, at Donald Trump Jr., you release your high school and college transcripts and SAT scores to prove you got into Wharton on merit, and I'll do the same for my Harvard acceptance. Speaking of Harvard, Jared Kushner went to Harvard,
right?
Ivanka's husband.
His dad paid a lot of money.
His dad reportedly pledged $2.5 million to Harvard not long before Jared was accepted. According to a story in ProPublica, in fact, administrators at Jared's high school described him as a less than stellar student and expressed dismay at Harvard's decision to accept him. By the way, his dad, Charles, is a big New York City real estate developer.
And also a convicted felon.
Who went to prison for 14 months. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Pat Regan wrote, I am disgusted by Lori's actions, and this makes me question if famous people even are good. Oh, Pat. Well, he writes, the university you attend should depend on how smart you are or if you're good at lacrosse, not if Mommy Dearest has made it into syndication. Which is fair enough.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, there's a lot of thinking and good thoughts out there in the Twitterverse and the social media world around this particular story. So if you haven't yet, dip your toe in because it's... It's okay. Very amusing.
All right. Thank you for dipping your toes in both feet. Christian Bordahl, I'm Madeline Brown. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.